grey blonde hair soaked, the water around him stained pinkish red. Maya bent down to turn him over and nearly gagged. His eyes were open, staring sightlessly at the sky, his throat sliced wide open. Maya. She felt a hand on her back. Jordan's. Don't. His sentence was cut off by a gasp, and she whirled around, only to find a sense of horror so intense that it nearly blacked out her vision. Jordan stood behind her, one hand outstretched, a look of utter shock on his face. From the center of his chest protruded the blade of a sword, its metal stamped with black stars. It looked utterly bizarre, as if someone had taped it there, or as if it was some sort of theatrical prop. Blood began to spread out in a circle around it, staining the front of his jacket. Jordan gave another bubbling gasp and slid to his knees, the sword retracting, slipping back out of his body as he collapsed to the ground and revealed what was behind him. A boy carrying a massive black and silver sword stood looking at Maya over Jordan's kneeling body. The hilt was slit with blood. In fact, he was bloody all over, from his pale hair to his boots, splattered with it as if he had stood in front of a fan blowing scarlet paint. He was grinning all over his face. "Maya Roberts and Jordan Kyle," he said. "Have I heard a lot about you?" Maya dropped to her knees, just as Jordan slumped sideways. She caught him, easing him down into her lap. She felt numb all over with horror, as if she were lying at the icy bottom of the sound. Jordan was shuddering in her arms, and she put them around him as blood ran out the corners of his mouth. She looked up at the boy standing over her. For a dizzy moment, she thought he had stepped out of one of her nightmares of her brother, Daniel. He was beautiful, like Daniel had been, though they could not have looked more different. Daniel's skin had been the same brown as hers, while this boy looked like he had been carved out of ice. White skin, sharp, pale cheekbones, salt-white hair that fell over his forehead. His eyes were black, shark's eyes, flat and cold. "Sebastian," she said. "You're Valentine's son." "Maya," Jordan whispered. Her hands were over his chest, and they were soaked in blood. So was his shirt, and the sand under them, the grains of it clumped together by sticky scarlet. "Don't stay. Run." "Shh." She kissed his cheek. "He'll be all right."
"No, he won't," Sebastian said, sounding bored. "He's going to die."
Maya's head jerked up. "Shut up," she hissed. "Shut up, you thing." His wrist made a fast snapping motion. She had never seen anyone else move that fast, except maybe Jace, and the tip of the sword was at her throat.
"Quiet, Downworlder," he said. "Look how many lie dead around you. Do you think I would hesitate to kill one more?"
She swallowed, but didn't lean away. "Why? I thought your war was with the Shadow Hunters."
"It's rather a long story," he drawled. "Suffice it to say that the London Institute is annoyingly well protected, and the Praetor has paid the price. I was going to kill someone today. I just wasn't sure who when I woke up this morning. But I do love mornings, so full of possibilities."
"The Praetor has nothing to do with the London Institute."
"Oh, you're wrong there. There's quite a history, but it's unimportant. You're correct that my war is with the Nephilim, which means I am also at war with their allies. This," and he swung his free hand back to indicate the burned ruins behind him, "is my message, and you will deliver it for me."
Maya began to shake her head, but felt something grip her hand. It was Jordan's fingers. She looked down at him. He was bone white, his eyes searching hers. "Please," they seemed to say. "Do what he asks." "What message?" she whispered.
"That they should remember their Shakespeare," he said. "I'll never pause again, never stand still till either death hath closed these eyes of mine or fortune given me measure of revenge."
Lashes brushed his bloody cheek as he winked.
"Tell all the Downworlders," he said. "I am in pursuit of vengeance, and I will have it. I will deal this way with any who ally themselves with Shadow Hunters. I have no argument with your kind, unless you follow the Nephilim into battle, in which case..." You will be food for my blade and the blades of my army until the last of you is cut from the surface of this world. He lowered the tip of his sword, so that it brushed down the buttons of her shirt as if he meant to slice it off her body. He was still grinning when he drew the sword back. Think you can remember that, wolf girl? Of course you can, he said, and glanced down at Jordan's body, which had gone still in her arms. Your boyfriend's dead, by the way, he added. He slid his sword into the scabbard at his waist and walked away, his boots sending up puffs of ash as he went.
Magnus hadn't been inside the Hunter's Moon since it had been a speakeasy during the years of Prohibition, a place where mundanes had gathered quietly to drink themselves blackout drunk. Sometime in the 1940s, it had been taken over by downworlder owners and had catered to that clientele, primarily werewolves, ever since. It had been seedy then and was seedy now, the floor covered with a layer of sticky sawdust. There was a wooden bar with a flecked countertop, marked with decades of rings left by damp glasses and long claw scratches. Sneaky Pete, the bartender, was in the middle of serving a Coke to Bat Velasquez, the temporary head of Luke's Manhattan Wolf Pack. Magnus squinted at him thoughtfully. "Are you eyeing up the new Wolf Pack leader?" asked Katerina, who was squeezed into the shadowy booth beside Magnus. Her blue fingers curled around a Long Island iced tea. "I thought you were over werewolves after Woolsey Scott." "I'm not eyeing him up," Magnus said loftily. "Bat wasn't bad-looking, if you liked them square-jawed and broad-shouldered." But Magnus was deep in thought. "My mind was on other things."
"Whatever it is, don't do it," said Katerina. "It's a bad idea."
"And why do you say that?"
"Because they're the only kind you have," she said. "I have known you a long time, and I am absolutely certain on this subject. If you are planning to become a pirate again, it's a bad idea."
"I don't repeat my mistakes," Magnus said, offended.
"You're right. You make all new and even worse mistakes," Katerina told him. "Don't do it, whatever it is. Don't lead a werewolf uprising. Don't do anything that might accidentally contribute to the apocalypse. And don't start your own line of glitter and try to sell it at Sephora."
"That last idea has real merit," Magnus remarked. "But I'm not contemplating a career change. I was thinking about..."
"Alec Lightwood?" Katerina grinned. "I've never seen anyone get under your skin like that boy."
"You haven't known me forever," Magnus muttered, but it was half-hearted.
"Please, you make me take the portal job at the Institute so you wouldn't have to see him, and then you showed up anyway just to say goodbye. Don't deny it. I saw you."
"I didn't deny anything. I showed up to say goodbye. It was a mistake. I shouldn't have done it." Magnus tossed back a slug of his drink.
"Oh, for goodness sake," said Katerina. "What is this about, really, Magnus? I've never seen you so happy as you were with Alec. Usually when you're in love, you're miserable. Look at Camille. I hated her. Ragnar hated her."
Magnus put his head down on the table. "Everyone hated her," Katerina went on ruthlessly. "She was devious and mean. And so your poor, sweet boyfriend got suckered by her. Well, really, is that any reason to end a perfectly good relationship? It's like sicking a python on a bunny rabbit and then being angry when the bunny rabbit loses."
"Alec is not a bunny rabbit. He's a shadow hunter." "And you've never dated a shadow hunter before? Is that what this is?"
Magnus pushed himself away from the table, which was a relief because it smelled like beer. "In a sense," he said, "the world is changing. Don't you feel it, Katerina?" She looked at him over the rim of her drink. "I can't say that I do." "The Nephilim have endured for 1,000 years, said Magnus. "But something is coming, some great change. We have always accepted them as a fact of our existence. But there are warlocks old enough to remember when the Nephilim did not walk the earth. They could be wiped away as quickly as they came."
"But you don't really think..."
"I've dreamed about it," he said. "You know I have true dreams sometimes."
"Because of your father."
She set her drink down. Her expression was intent now, no humor in it.
"He could just be trying to frighten you,"
Katerina was one of the few people in the world who knew who Magnus's father really was. Ragnar Fell had been another. It wasn't something Magnus liked to tell people. It was one thing to have a demon for a parent. It was another thing when your father owned a significant portion of Hell's real estate. To what end? Magnus shrugged. I am not the center of whatever whirlwind is coming. But you're afraid Alec will be, said Katerina, and you want to push him away before you lose him. You said not to do anything that might accidentally contribute to the apocalypse, Magnus said. I know you were joking, but it's less funny when I can't rid myself of the feeling that the apocalypse is coming somehow. Valentine Morgenstern nearly wiped out the Shadowhunters, and his son is twice as clever and six times as evil. And he will not come alone. He has help. From demons greater than my father. From others. How do you know that? Katerina's voice was sharp. I've looked into it. I thought you were done helping Shadowhunters, said Katerina. And then she held up a hand before he could say anything. Never mind. I've heard you say that sort of thing enough times to know you never really mean it. That's the thing, Magnus said. I've looked into it, but I haven't found anything. Whoever Sebastian's allies are, he's left no tracks of their alliance behind. I keep feeling like I'm about to discover something, and then I find myself grasping at air. I don't think I can help them, Katerina. I don't know if anyone can. Magnus looked away from her suddenly pitying expression across the bar. Bat was leaning against the counter, playing with his phone. The light from the screen cast shadows across his face. Shadows that Magnus saw on every mortal face, every human, every shadow hunter, every creature doomed to die. Mortals die, said Katerina. You've always known that, and yet you've loved them before. Not, Magnus said, like this. Katerina inhaled in surprise. Oh, she said. Oh. She picked up her drink. Magnus, she said tenderly, you are impossibly stupid. He narrowed his eyes at her. Am I? If that's the way you feel, you should be with him, she said. Think of Tessa. Did you learn nothing from her? About what loves are worth the pain of losing them? He's in Alicante. So? Said Katerina. You were supposed to be the warlock representative on the council. You unloaded that responsibility onto me. I'm unloading it back. Go to Alicante. It sounds to me like you'll have more to say to the council than I ever could anyway. She reached into the pocket of the nurse's scrub she was wearing. She had come directly from her work at the hospital. Oh, and take this. Magnus plucked the crumpled piece of paper from her fingertips. A dinner invitation, he said in disbelief. Meliorn of the Fairfolk wishes for all the council downworlders to meet for supper the night before the great council, she said. Some kind of gesture of peace and goodwill. Or maybe he just wants to annoy everyone with riddles. Either way, it should be interesting. Fairy food, Magnus said glumly. I hate fairy food. I mean, even the safe kind that doesn't mean you'll be stuck dancing reels for the next century. All those raw vegetables and beetles. He broke off. Across the room, Bat had his phone pressed to his ear. His other hand gripped the counter of the bar. There's something wrong, Magnus said. Something pack-related. Katerina set her glass down. She was very used to Magnus, and knew when he was probably right. She looked over at Bat as well, who had snapped his phone shut. He had paled, his scar standing out, livid on his cheek. He leaned over to say something to Sneaky Pete behind the bar, then put two fingers in his mouth and whistled. It sounded like the whistle of a steam train, and cut through the low murmur of voices in the bar. In moments, every lycanthrope was on his or her feet, surging toward Bat. Magnus stood up too, though Katerina caught at his sleeve. Don't. I'll be fine. He shrugged her off and pushed through the crowd toward Bat. The rest of the pack stood in a loose ring around him. They tensed mistrustfully at the sight of the warlock in their midst. shoving to get close to their pack leader. A blonde female werewolf moved to block Magnus, but Bat held up a hand. "It's all right, Amabel," he said. His voice wasn't friendly, but it was polite. "Magnus Bane, right? High Warlock of Brooklyn? Maya Roberts says I can trust you."
"You can."
"Fine. But we have urgent pack business here. What do you want?"
"You got a call."
Magnus gestured toward Bat's phone.
"Was it Luke?
Has something happened in Alicante?" Bat shook his head, his expression unreadable.
"Another Institute attack, then?" Magnus said. He was used to being the one with all the answers, and hated not knowing anything. And while the New York Institute was empty, that didn't mean the other institutes were unprotected, that there might not have been a battle, one Alec might have decided to involve himself in.
"Not an institute," Bat said. "That was Maya on the phone. The Praetor Lupus headquarters were burned to the ground. At least 100 werewolves are dead, including Praetor Scott and Jordan Kyle. Sebastian Morgenstern has taken his fight to us."
6. Brother Lead and Sister Steel. "Don't throw it, please, please, don't throw—" "Oh, God, he threw it," said Julian in a resigned voice as a wedge of potato flew across the room, narrowly missing his ear. "Nothing's damaged," Emma reassured him. She was sitting with her back against Tavi's crib, watching Julian give his littlest brother his afternoon meal. Tavi had reached the age where he was very particular about what he liked to eat, and anything that didn't pass muster was hurled to the floor. "The lamp got a little potatoed, that's all." Fortunately, though the rest of the Penhallows' house was quite elegant, the attic where the war orphans, the collective term that had been applied to the Blackthorn children and Emma since they'd arrived in Idris for now living, was extremely plain, functional, and sturdy in its design. It took up the whole top floor of the house, several connected rooms, a small kitchen and bathroom, a haphazard collection of beds and belongings strewn everywhere. Helen slept downstairs with Aline, though she was up every day. Emma had been given her own room, and so had Julian, but he was hardly ever in it. Drusilla and Octavian were still waking up every night screaming, and Julian had taken to sleeping on the floor of their room, pillow and blanket piled up next to Tavi's crib. There was no high chair to be had, so Julian sat on the floor opposite the toddler on a food-covered blanket, a plate in one hand and a despairing look on his face. Emma came over and sat down opposite him, heaving Tavi up onto her lap. His small face was scrunched with unhappiness. "Memma," he said as she lifted him. "Do the choo-choo train," she advised Jules. She wondered if she should tell him that he had spaghetti sauce in his hair. On second thought, probably better not. She watched as he zoomed the food around before placing it in Tavi's mouth. The toddler was giggling now. Emma tried to shove down her sense of loss. She remembered her own father, patiently separating out the food on her plate during the phase she'd gone through where she refused to eat anything that was green. "He's not eating enough," Jules said in a quiet voice, even as he made a piece of bread and butter into a chugging train and Tavi reached for it with sticky hands. "He's sad. He's a baby, but he still knows something bad happened," Emma said. "He misses Mark and your dad." Jules scrubbed tiredly at his eyes, leaving a smear of tomato sauce on one cheekbone. "I can't replace Mark or my dad." He put a slice of apple in Tavi's mouth. Tavi spat it out with a look of grim pleasure. Julian sighed. "I should go check on Drew and the twins," he said. "They were playing Monopoly in the bedroom, but you never know when that's going to go south." It was true. Tiberius, with his analytical mind, tended to win most games. Livy never minded, but Drew, who was competitive, did, and often any match would end in hair-pulling on both sides. "I'll do it," Emma handed Tavi back and was about to rise to her feet when Helen came in the room, looking somber. When she saw the two of them, somberness turned to apprehension. Emma felt the hair on the back of her neck rise. "Helen," Julian said, "what's wrong?" "Sebastian's forces attacked the London Institute." Emma saw Julian tense. She almost felt it, as if his nerves were her nerves, his panic her panic. His face, already too thin, seemed to tighten, though he kept the same careful, gentle grasp on the baby. "Uncle Arthur?" he asked. "He's all right," Helen said quickly.
He was injured. It'll delay his arrival in Idris, but he's all right. In fact, everyone from the London Institute is all right. The attack was unsuccessful. How? Julian's voice was barely a whisper. We don't know yet. Not exactly, said Helen. I'm going over to the guard with Aline and the consul and the rest to try to figure out what happened. She knelt down and stroked her hand over Tavi's curls. It's good news, she said to Julian, who looked more stunned than anything else. I know it's scary that Sebastian attacked again, but he didn't win. Emma met Julian's eyes with hers. She felt as if she ought to be thrilled at the good news, but there was a tearing feeling inside her, a terrible jealousy. Why did the inhabitants of the London Institute get to live when her family died? How had they fought better, done more? It's not fair, Julian said. Jules, said Helen, standing up, it's a defeat. That means something. It means we can defeat Sebastian and his forces. Take them down, turn the tide. It will make everyone less afraid. That's important. I hope they catch him alive, said Emma, her eyes on Julian's. I hope they kill him in Angel Square so we can all watch him die, and I hope it's slow. Emma, said Helen, sounding shocked, but Julian's blue-green eyes echoed Emma's own fierceness back to her without a hint of disapproval. Emma had never loved him so much as she did in that moment, for reflecting back to her even the darkest feelings in the depths of her own heart. The weapon shop was gorgeous. Clary never thought she would have described a weapon shop as gorgeous before, maybe a sunset or a clear night view of the New York skyline, but not a shop full of maces, axes, and sword canes. This one was, though. The metal sign that hung outside was in the shape of a quiver, the name of the store, Diana's Arrow, inscribed on it in curling letters. Inside the shop were blades displayed in deadly fans of gold and steel and silver. A massive chandelier hung from a ceiling painted with a rococo design of golden arrows in flight. Real arrows were displayed on carved wooden stands. Tibetan longswords, their pommels decorated with turquoise, silver, and coral, hung on the walls alongside Burmese dar blades with hammered metal tangs in copper and brass. So what brought this on? Jace asked curiously, taking down a naginata carved with Japanese characters. When he set it on the floor, the blade rose over his head, his long fingers curving around the shaft to hold it steady. This desire for a sword. When a 12-year-old tells you the weapon you have sucks, it's time to change it up, said Clary. The woman behind the counter laughed. Clary recognized her as the woman with the tattoo of the fish who had spoken out at the council meeting. Well, you've come to the best place. Is this your shop? Clary asked, reaching to test the point of a longsword with an iron hilt. The woman smiled. I'm Diana, yes, Diana Rayburn. Clary reached for the rapier, but Jace, having leaned the naginata against the wall, shook his head at her. That claymore would be taller than you, not that that's hard. Clary stuck her tongue out at him and reached for a short sword hanging on the wall. There were scratches along the blade, scratches that on closer examination she could see were clearly letters in a language she didn't know. Those are runes, but not Shadowhunter runes, said Diana. That's a Viking sword, very old, and very heavy. Do you know what it says? Only the worthy, said Diana. My father used to say you could tell a great weapon if it had either a name or an inscription. I saw one yesterday, Clary recalled. It said something like, I am of the same steel and temper as Joyeuse and Durandal. Cortana? Diana's eyes lit up. The blade of Ogier. That is impressive, like owning Excalibur or Kusanagi no Tsurugi. Cortana is a Carstairs blade, I think. Is Emma Carstairs, the girl who was at the council meeting yesterday, the one who owns it now? Clary nodded. Diana pursed her lips. Poor child, she said, and the Blackthorns, too. To have lost so many in a single sweeping blow, I wish there was something I could do for them. Me too, Clary said. Diana gave her a measured look and ducked down behind the counter. She came up a moment later with a sword about the length of Clary's forearm. What do you think of this? Clary stared at the sword. It was undoubtedly beautiful. The crossguard, grip, and pommel were gold-chased with obsidian. The blade a silver so dark it was nearly black. Clary's mind ran quickly through the types of weapons she had been memorizing in her lessons. Falchions, sabers, backswords, longswords.
Is it a chinquidia? She guessed. It's a short sword. You might want to look at the other side, said Diana as she flipped the sword over. On the opposite side of the blade, down the center ridge, ran a pattern of black stars. Oh. Clary's heart thumped painfully. She took a step back and nearly bumped into Jace, who had come up behind her, frowning. That's a Morgenstern sword. Yes, it is. Diana's eyes were shrewd. Long ago, the Morgensterns commissioned two blades from Wayland the Smith, a matched set, a larger and a smaller, for a father and his son. Because Morgenstern means morning star, they were each named for a different aspect of the star itself. The smaller, this one here, is called Heosphorus, which means Dawnbringer, while the larger is called Phosphorus, or Lightbringer. You have doubtless seen Phosphorus already, for Valentine Morgenstern carried it. And now his son carries it after him. You know who we are, Jace said. It wasn't a question. Who Clary is. The Shadowhunter world is small, said Diana, and she looked from one of them to the other. I'm on the council. I've seen you give testimony, Valentine's daughter. Clary looked doubtfully at the blade. I don't understand, she said. Valentine would never have given up a Morgenstern sword. How do you have it? His wife sold it, Diana said, to my father, who owned the shop in the days before the uprising. It was hers. It should be yours now. Clary shuddered. I've seen two men bear the larger version of that sword, and I hated them both. There are no Morgensterns in this world now who are dedicated to anything but evil. Jay said, there's you. She glanced over at him, but his expression was unreadable. I couldn't afford it anyway, Clara said. That's gold and black gold and Adamus. I don't have the money for that kind of weapon. I'll give it to you, said Diana. You're right that people hate the Morgensterns. They tell stories of how the swords were created and contain deadly magic to slay thousands at once. They're just stories, of course, no truth to them, but still. It's not the sort of item I could sell elsewhere, or would necessarily want to. It should go to good hands. I don't want it, Clary whispered. If you flinch from it, you give it power over you, said Diana. Take it and cut your brother's throat with it, and take back the honor of your blood. She slid the sword across the counter to Clary. Wordlessly, Clary picked it up, her hand curling around the pommel, finding that it fit her grip, fit it exactly as if it had been made for her. Despite the steel and precious metal in the sword's construction, it felt as light as a feather in her hand. She raised it up, the black stars along the blade winking at her, a light like fire running, sparking along the steel. She looked up to see Diana catch something out of the air, a glimmer of light that resolved itself into a piece of paper. She read down it, her eyebrows knitting together in concern. By the angel, she said. The London Institute's been attacked. Clary almost dropped the blade. She heard Jace suck in his breath beside her. What? He demanded. Diana looked up. It's all right, she said. Apparently there's some kind of special protection laid on the London Institute, something even the council didn't know about. There were some injuries, but no one was killed. Sebastian's forces were rebuffed. Unfortunately, none of the Andarkin were captured or killed either. As Diana spoke, Clary realized that the shop owner was wearing white mourning clothes. Had she lost someone in Valentine's War? In Sebastian's attacks on the Institutes? How much blood had been spilled by Morgenstern hands? I'm so sorry, Clary gasped. She could see Sebastian, see him clearly in her head, red gear and red blood, silver hair and silver blade. She reeled back. There was a hand on her arm suddenly, and she realized she was breathing in cold air. Somehow, she was outside the weapon shop on a street full of people, and Jace was beside her. Clary, he was saying, it's all right, everything is all right. The London Shadowhunters, they all escaped. Diana said there were injuries, she said. More blood spilled because of Morgenstern's. He glanced down at the blade, still clutched in her right hand, her fingers bloodless on the hilt. You don't have to take the sword. No, Diana was right. Being afraid of everything Morgenstern, it gives Sebastian power over me, which is exactly what he wants. I agree, Jay said. That's why I brought you this.